Tomorrow evening sees the start of a new series called Celebrity Namesakes. The Monty Python gang meets some snakes, Hot Gossip meets some magazine writers, and Dick Van Dyke is on the show too. Up next, 80s Nostalgia chats to his old school friend and current music promoter, Paul Bennett.
Who the hell is this guy? Why do we care?
So run me through a typical Monday in the 80s, how it's for you.
Right, well, Mondays, early 80s, 80 to 83, so I'd be about 10. I think I remember desperately wanting to watch programmes on the telly, comedies that I probably wasn't allowed to watch. I'm desperately trying to work out whether this was when we had a portable black and white telly up in the bedroom. Me and my brother shared a bedroom, and I think that might have been. So primary school was Blackadder and Only Fools and Horses. So I remember, and I think I remember people like you and certainly Gary Spencer and one or two others waxing very lyrical about how cool this Only Fools and Horses and Blackadder was. And I wasn't allowed to watch it. And I think I used to sneak watching it on, and I think it was on. Might have been on a Sunday or a Monday or something like that. So that's kind of sneaking, really kind of grainy black and white telly watching on a whole manner. And thinking it was awesome. And I'm looking back now with hindsight, genuinely believing that my parents had no idea that we were doing it. Of course, they knew everything. I mean, you could hear it and just kind of a bit of peace and quiet.
Do you remember black and white tellies?
Absolutely. I remember V-Hold. And I used to know all the UHF frequencies of all the channels because you couldn't store a channel, it was a dial. So like 56 was BBC One or something like that. Yeah. Okay, I thought, yeah, if I remember that.
40 was your Spectrum.
That was your Channel 8 stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah. Push button. Let's go back to early 80s when you're 6 or 7 years old.
Okay.
What would a normal start of a day be for you on a school day?
Years could be mixed up here, but I think I remember a satchel and I remember a pair of shoes that didn't fit. And that's the first sort of memories. And lots of memories of assembly. And I think I'm very aware that I was a bit taller than everyone else.
What, we're about 6'2" now?
Yeah, not then.
Not when you were 7, No.
Probably about 5'11" then. I remember being taller than most people, but that felt odd. And I remember just wanting to fit in, I think was the overriding memory, but again, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast.
Do you remember playing anything in the playground? Or what lessons do you remember? What about school specifically?
Right, I remember a Wind in the Willows play.
Do you know, I did the lights for that.
I was Badger.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd realised that was the main part, but I think I was always cast as like the grown-up in the thing. I think I was taller, yeah. And we had this papier-mâché head of what I now know to be a badger. It never occurred to me that it looked like a badger. I remember it was a very distinct memory that from before the dress rehearsal, I was to have a newspaper, The Times. Now, I wasn't aware that this thing got printed daily. I thought, you know, how on earth am I going to get a copy of The Times newspaper? And my mum went to a shop, we bought a copy of The Times. It wasn't that big a deal. But I remember being quite impressed that my mum knew how to get a copy of The Times newspaper. I've never read it.
It was only the 80s. It wasn't like a village.
No, exactly. So I have a very distinct memory of being the grown-up in that kind of play thing. I remember watching, what was it called? Watch It Down? I remember the blue curtains, the blue in the hall, the big long blue curtains, that sort of thing. And then occasionally, when it would part and you'd get that sunburst through, and all the dust and everything would just start on them. And the paraphernalia that went with that big telly that had to be opened up, and there'd be flaps and a top screen and a bottom screen and.
So mad. They had one TV for the school and they'd wheel it about through all different.
Well, I still thought that was amazing. I mean. Bear in mind, you look at someone who had like a 7-14-inch type portable. So this thing was massive. And just, I think, looking back on it now, I think that's probably where my fascination with telly and like radio and broadcast entertainment probably started.
Do you have a favourite teacher that you remember?
I know she got married during the term, but I think I remember Mrs. Manfredi.
I remember the name.
Yeah. I remember Mrs. McLean and Mrs. Britton. And I think they were kind of my favourite teachers. What became apparent, I think, later on in primary school was my mum and dad were big churchy people, so we had to go to church. And that put a lot of my teachers in contact with my parents in, like, odd social, which I've just never really got comfortable with. But, yeah, that's it, Barry. I remember one very, very distinct thing. Again, I'm sure Lee would be happy to be credited with this story. We were doing a science lesson, and we had a really old science book. And in it, I remember distinctly, it said, "The molecule is the smallest element known to man." And I remember Lee just putting his hand up saying, "No, it's not. There's atoms. Atoms are smaller than molecules." And I just remember thinking, because Lee lived not quite the same street, but almost. And he, that I remember very, very distinctly, the kudos that Lee then had in my eyes then for challenging a textbook. Yeah. And I never stopped challenging teachers after that. Right. I always wanted to be cleverer than the thing, even though it was probably an irritating little... Well, you know, once it was proven that you could challenge a teacher or challenge a textbook, I was all over that.
So what happened? Did he just put his hand up and say it and the teacher agreed?
I can't remember, because all I remember was just going, like, wow, that's amazing. And it just brushed over and carried on, and I can't remember whether she agreed. I'm sure she said something like, yes, whatever, and we moved on. It wasn't like the reaction from everybody else didn't seem that big, but yeah, I remember Lee challenging that textbook.
Lee is a genius.
Oh, absolutely. We tried to make a laser of me, Lee, out of a shoebox. I remember.
Really?
Shoebox with a torch.
How'd you do that?
We didn't, but we knew it had something to do with torches and mirrors and bouncing light around. Yeah, so we just had a collection of mirrors in a shoebox, and he shone a torch at the end. And that was it. I mean, there was a brief mention of the word nanometer, and that was about it.
That's pretty much science, though, isn't it?
Absolutely,
it defines science. So what was the outside of learning and the playground? What were you playing in the playground?
Right, so I remember, did we call it Wally or something? You know, in the playground, it was almost like the wall was almost in sections. Okay, so like pillars, and then a bit in between, and another pillar in between. And we'd pick one of the bits in between, and you had to throw, like, say, a tennis ball or a sponge ball or something. And you had to hit that, and it would get it to fly off somewhere else. Then the next person would have to go and run and get the ball, and then hit the same target from, obviously, further away. And if they missed, they were out. And I got quite good at that, because I would just stand really close to it, and I could throw a ball quite a long way. So, yeah, I remember that.
Do you ever play that game where you had to stand, people had to run between your legs if you got
things? Yes.
What was that called?
I can't remember, but it was there was lots of things. There was sometimes they'd pass a ball between your legs and then over the top and then run back round. Yeah, I was never really, really big into that, but I remember all the kind of stuff.
One of the dinner ladies fell over on some ice once.
Yeah.
She came out to tell us off for making a skinny patch.
Oh, yeah, a skinny patch, yeah.
You need a good skinny patch when you're at primary school.
Yeah.
Came up, went to stand on it, told us off and fell over.
Yeah.
And it was by far the funniest thing we saw all week.
Yeah. I think people falling over was I mean, that's what goes through the week, wasn't it?
Exactly.
I'm just looking at your notes here. Yeah. Are we going to do the hockey stick thing?
That's the next one.
That's right. Are we doing, because I haven't thought of that. I haven't thought of that until I just saw it then.
I was sat in a pub with my cousin, who's the perpetrator.
All right. Oh, is it your cousin?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
How weird is that?
Okay.
I found out when I was about 7 or 8 and I burst into tears. But I didn't really like him. But my cousin.
Okay.
I like him now, obviously. Yeah, it was great. But when I found out 7 or 8 year old, I was devastated.
Well, I remember very, very distinctly. I guess for people listening, right? So we got it was our first go at hockey. And you know, those big sort of balls, oversized plastic balls with holes in them. And I remember me and I was going to say Ivan, basically Ivan. So, and I was on the tallest. Ivan wasn't. And we both had our sticks over our shoulder, and we were both basically just like going to swing at this ball on the floor as hard as we could. And I think he hit me before I hit him. No, absolutely not intentional. I mean, just we just didn't know how this thing worked. And I remember being hit on the head. by this hockey stick at full whack. I remember falling over. I remember the blood. I remember nothing else until that evening. I was taken to hospital.
Apparently, yeah.
And all I remember was they were saying, we don't do stitches anymore. They do staples. So I remember they put, and again, great audio. The scar's still there. So these things clamped into you to wherever the stitches were to go and closed up. And I had three staples in my head or something. And I remember the following day at school, I mean, given that I was all right, I quite enjoyed the attention. But people didn't believe me. I remember the teacher saying, well, nobody has staples in their head. And it was like, as if I'd made it up. I was like, well, no, I hadn't. But there we go. Yeah, so I remember that quite clear. And I do remember people coming round to the house that night. Because where we lived was almost... Well, where we lived was on the corner, as lots of people would pass school. So it was quite convenient for people just to pop in and say, is Paul all right? And I remember that happening a lot.
When I was chatting to Ivan a few years ago, I said, do you remember that time that you hit Paul on the head with the hockey stick?
Yeah.
We were laughing and joking before that.
Yeah.
And he genuinely was like, I thought I killed him.
Yeah.
He was absolutely devastated.
I remember the stories that Ivan was really upset, but I passed in cross for a while, but not deliberately. Gosh, that's taking me back.
So what were your best memories at school? That's obviously one of the worst ones, or one.
Well, the best memories.
Did you win any awards? Did you have any good reviews at parents' evenings?
Yeah, I think it was when I realised I was probably one of the brightest or brighter ones, and I loved tests and exams and results. Because I kind of used to do all right with them. So I think the show-off me kind of enjoyed doing well in school, really. And it's only now I look back, I realise my mum and dad were involved in the governors and the church, all that kind of stuff. So I think without necessarily realising it, I probably got quite a bit of preferential treatment. I was probably picked for things that, you know, kind of... Oh, that remember when me and Gary Spencer went into the kitchen to make bread?
I don't know this, no.
No, this is my... Right.
Describe this for me.
Okay, so there was a scheme, and I can't remember what the scheme was for, but you had to pick a card, and it was like an activity once per week, and you had to pair up, and each pair would do a different activity as described on this card. And I'd clocked these in advance. This one was called Growth, and I'd read it before it had been handed out. I'd sneak to look. And it said, like, this is actually about going making bread in a school kitchen. I went, that sounds pretty cool. And I said to Gary, look, trust me, the one that sounds the most boring, Growth, is the most interesting. Make sure we pick that one. So we did. Yeah, so me and Gary Spencer had a morning in, because it was the third, we were the first ones to do it. So I remember we'd made this lattice bread. It was pretty cool, that. And that was pretty cool.
But in a way, you cheated, kind of, because you read it.
Mate, I was always cheating. I was always finding a little, you know, trying to find some kind of angle or way in or something.
Can I
remember peak maths, that's it. And I remember one of the teachers had left the answer book out, and I had a proper good scan of those. And because I'd remembered all the answers and the patterns. So when it came to the tests, I was, piece of cake, yes. Now, I'd like to think I'd have got them right anyway, but, you know.
You were checking it.
I did all right. I remember it was very often it was me and Emma would be like, if I wasn't top, she'd be top and she was tired. And I remember competing with Emma a lot and cheating without her realising it.
I need to confess something.
Oh yeah?
I confessed it to Leif.
Oh yeah?
And to Ivan.
Oh yeah?
But when we were at primary school,
yeah.
And this is quite a big confession.
Oh okay.
There was a competition to win some Conti painting pencils.
Oh yeah?
And it was a colouring competition. You had to colour in, hand it in the day after and the week.
They
were judged.
And
I ended up winning that competition.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason I won is because my dad coloured it in for me.
Brilliant.
And I got some Conti painting pencils. I was really pleased with them because they were like... And then within a few weeks, they had been stolen. I was devastated, even though I hadn't earned them.
It's life skills.
And then when I was 20... maybe 21, me, Ivan and Leif sat in a pub and I confessed to Lee that I'd cheated in this competition and he genuinely hasn't spoken to me since. Complete honesty. He's not spoken a word to me since.
Not because of that.
He swore violently
and
then we parted ways.
We need a peace envoy to broker some peace here. We'll be right back. Manchester about 2-3 weeks ago. Yes. Did you bump into, or my ex partner said she said no, hang on, she got your name wrong. Chris, that's right. She said I bumped into your mate Chris. I went, what? And she's proper detailed, but she said, yeah, definitely. And I showed the photograph. She said, that's him. I said, that's Craig. He said, he definitely had a name tag on that said Chris. And I said, well, he's the kind of person that would have the sense of humour that should that opportunity present itself, he'll swap. But yeah, look at this. Right, see, this is now I've become I'm a proper music promoter. Nigel Twist, the drummer from The Alarm, won my first band. So I'm mates with him on Facebook. And I just sent this in. So he was on the side of the stage as Status Quo are opening up for Live Aid. That's amazing. Wow.
So you got the Alarm guy from The Alarm playing soon?
Yes, yes. Dave Sharp. Yes. Guitar player from The Alarm.
How did you get into that?
How do I become a promoter?
How did you get him, first of all?
Just, that was, ultimately, I learned it's a very small world. And Dave Sharp was from this neck of the woods and still gigs a bit. So being the ex-guitar player in a middle-of-the-road kind of band in the 80s, he's still having to play to earn. So he's still seeing him knocking about playing. So I knew he still played, and then I happened to become friends with a friend of his by accident. I'd been to see Dave Sharp at my new friend Ali's bar about 4 years ago. And then our paths crossed again, and I didn't realise, because I'm now promoting acts and he has artists to promote. And I was saying, well, this is the fees. And in all the negotiation stuff, he said, Paul, that's a bit harsh. I said, I used to run a venue for 9 years. He basically was saying my conditions were too onerous. And I said, I'm sorry, mate, that's what it's like in Manchester now. He went, no, I'm not having that. He said, I ran, and he named the bar. And I went, hang on a minute, are you mates with Dave Sharp? He went, yeah, why? I said, well, I've been to every one of Dave Sharp's shows at your venue. So then all the negotiation things went away, and he was, do you reckon he'd play for me? Oh, he said, oh, things are changing now. I said, yeah, they might. So, yeah, so I ran a venue and put a night on. He came around to check that it was all legit and kosher. He said, right, I'll get in touch with Dave. What's your terms? He's don't offer him something. He's not into negotiation. Just offer him what you want to pay, and he'll either say yeah or nay. So we went to... We're not stupid money, but more than what we'd normally pay. Because the balance for me is I've got my business model. I got to pay for the artist, pay for the venue, and then try to sell more tickets at a number high enough to pay for the two.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. And there was an element with booking Dave Sharp. I went, there's an element in me that's treated as like a private booking, even if I wasn't a promoter. Quit to meet Dave Sharp, and I've been playing for a couple of hours. Yeah, I'd do that. Yeah, so that's kind of where it's at. And if I can sell tickets on the side and make him a bit of money, we might become mates. my ultimate goal is to work with Springsteen. Springsteen's worked with Mike Peters. Mike Peters was in The Alarm. Dave Sharp was in The Alarm. So that's my three steps. I mean, you've got to dream and you've got to have a go, otherwise you become an engineer for 20 years.
I like that philosophy. Yeah. I like that three steps thing. So what bands were you into when you were at school?
First band was Queen, and that was because of an older boy at Scouts. When I moved to this new Scout group, there was a boy that was slightly older, and I didn't know anybody. Of course, I said Phillips, kind of knew everybody, but this was Methodist, which we didn't really know anyone. There was an older lad who was into Queen, and Status Quo, as it turns out. And that was definitely 1984, 85. I remember Queen, A Kind of Magic, on vinyl, and then on cassette. He had it on vinyl, and he did me a copy of it, which I listened to. I loved it. And then, of course, Live Aid, Queen stole the show, and I'm thinking, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. So I sat and watched Live Aid all the way through until as late as possible. Barely moved from the sofa from midday right through till them finishing with Do They Know It's Christmas.
Did you have a video recorder?
When we didn't have a video recorder in our house until much later, when my taste had got into a bit more rock and metal. Because I think other people in the school, people like and Gary, to a point, were listening to music, Marillion and Aerosmith and Iron Maiden and that kind of stuff. And I'd been around to house, he could play the guitar, and he was showing me all these metal riffs. And I'm quite into that. And there was a program on Friday night, well, early hours Saturday morning. So 4 a.m. kind of thing. And we just record it every week without fail. And that was how I got into sort of the more rocky kind of music. So Queen, then The Alarm. I like The Alarm because, well, I like The Alarm. Let's just leave it at that.
Which other bands were you aware of that you may not like?
Right, so Genesis, Marillion at the start. I knew Gary was going on and on and on about Marillion. And it was more because Gary was going on about it. It kind of turned me off at first. But then a couple of years later, I caught up and liked them. They're probably my favourite band. Then there was that weird bit of thrash metal, that was like Anthrax and Slayer, that Ivan was kind of well into. And I got a bit intimidated by all that kind of stuff, I think. But yeah, so the thrash metal stuff I was aware of. And then there was the other group that was sort of into that, the early days hip-hop stuff, so LL Cool J and Beastie Boys, that kind of thing.
One of the first singles I bought was Anthrax, because I heard I'm the Man on the radio.
Yeah.
It was just funny, it made me laugh. It was like metal-y, yeah, but it was a bit dancing, a bit sort of innuendo-y. But yeah. I must have been about 12 at the time when I heard it. So I went to Tesco, yeah, where you could buy records, and I bought the single, and the woman was a bit, should I sell it to him? He was only 12. But I bought it, got it home, and the stereo was in the front room, yeah, there, so I put the earphones in, yeah, big chunky earphones, put those on, yeah, I listened to it, and I was mortified, because it was swearing in it.
Yeah.
And the radio one.
Yeah, of course,
radio edit. It had radio edit.
Yeah.
So I went out of the room,
yeah,
a bit upset that I'd bought something that was so nasty.
Yeah.
My mum saw me leave.
Yeah.
My mum put the earphones, yeah, on, had listened to it, see what I bought.
Yeah.
She was disgusted.
Yeah, absolutely.
She called me dad.
Yeah.
Dad put the earphones in. So pretty much the entire family listened to this awful song.
Yeah.
I felt like it was one of those moments where everyone gets involved. Yeah. All the neighbours, of course.
What do you think of this? I've listened to it.
Can you believe
it? Effing and Jeffing in front of our Craig.
So embarrassing.
Yeah, I can imagine. I was just really into Queen and The Alarm until to probably university, probably there. Well, no, when did I get into Merlin? I think I got into Merlin like 5th year at school. So I think it was because Fish had left and the new singer, Steve Hogarth, had joined. And Gary was in bits about all this. And so to me, it was like a bit of a soap opera because I used to sit next to Gary in English. So every week at English, it was just Gary's latest instalment of his tirade against what was happening in Marillion. And in the end, you couldn't, if you were in Gary's circle, you couldn't help but not eventually have a listen to Marillion.
Yeah. Went round to his house once, and he put on the same song 3 times.
Yeah. I bet I know which one it was as well. I bet it was The Party.
I honestly can't remember which one it was. But
he didn't say it to me. He wouldn't let me go until I agreed I liked it.
He put it on, and he said, right, listen to the drums. Yeah. So I listened to the entire 6-minute song with drums, and it's like, and the drums good. And I go, listen to guitar this time.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're like, same song.
It never occurred to me that you could listen to a song in that level of detail. And of course, I now do. Yeah. So it's kind of weird. Gary has a lot to answer for the Atherton Marillion.
It does.
A little pocket of Marillion stalwarts.
It sort of spreads out from the center of Atherton.
Yeah.
What was the first band that you saw live?
The Alarm. I remember it. In fact, because I was with... And, of course, I'm sharing the news on Facebook at the moment that, again, my teenage dreams have come true. I'm now booking an original member of The Alarm to come put on a gig for us. It just blows my head, that. And, of course, Gary and Dadge are, like, bringing back memories and that kind of thing. So, yeah, very, very, very clear memories of The Alarm at the Apollo. My first recollection was just how loud it was. Mm. I never realised that's what live music was. And I remember my tummy rumbling. I remember physical reactions with just how deep and heavy the bass was. In fact, it was a normal rock band. But I remember that being a real key moment in my life, which was just, this is amazing. I want to experience this forever.
How old were you?
It was fifth form. And yeah, I remember, because I used to really fancy a girl called... Can't put this in. You can't.
I'll blank the names out.
Yeah, okay. And had a badge, an Alarm badge, and it was a cool badge. The way they'd done the branding of the name, the sort of the logo of the name, was pretty cool, and that attracted my attention. And of course, one of the, I think it was like the old Grey Whistle Test, had come back from modern reboot, no, it'd be 89-90. And I remember trying to learn as much as I could about this song that came on The Alarm on the telly on a Sunday, so I could have something to talk to about. And now, what I later learned is this particular song that's on the telly this Sunday afternoon is a massive departure from The Alarm's norm. It's a big symphony choir. Mm. It's a big, gentle, it's a political song. Nothing at all like The Alarm, but it's the first Alarm song I hear. So I'm trying to play it all cool. I used to see The Alarm on telly yesterday. She went, yeah, what do you think of it? She said, oh, I didn't know you like The Alarm, that kind of stuff. I said, oh yeah, love The Alarm. What do you think of the new song then? I said, oh, it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Yeah, what, you like it? And I could tell something weird's going on. So I was digging it. I said, well, yeah. He said, do you not think it's like massively different from everything else? Of course, I've only ever really fumbling around, making a right fool of myself, pretending I knew more than I did, not for the first time. But then, like 2 or 3 years later on, bumped into her at an alarm gig.
Oh, right.
And finally she said, oh, well, okay, fair play, you know, good, isn't it? So, yeah, outgrew her in terms of trying to impress somebody, but loved the alarm.
And where would you find out more about bands? Do you get magazines?
Well, this is the weird thing. I was thinking about this the other day. Posters on the side of towns. There was a particular... If we drove into Manchester, there was a particular set of billboards. Or not billboards, but like industrial partitions kind of thing, where people would fly post gig posters.
Yeah.
So there was that run of them. And then there was also... There was a coach company in Atherton. Do you remember where like Spinner's Arms were?
Yeah.
Right, so opposite there, there was a little EFS Coaches or something it was. And they used to do gig, you know, ticket and coach. And they had an advert in the journal every week of where, you know, so Wembley, NEC, Birmingham, the Apollo. So all the big gigs. So that's when I knew who was playing, just by who was advertising on those coach trips. Teletext as well. I think Teletext was often... Once I'd figured out there was a Teletext page that had, like, local gigs. But I had no means of getting there, and it was having to persuade parents to drive and that kind of thing. But yeah.
If you think, we were, like, 15, 16 at the end of the 80s. If we'd have been 18, 19, 20-ish...
Yeah, exactly.
We'd have got some more, I think.
Exactly, definitely. Now, mentioning Anthrax. So Oliver... And we weren't exactly busy mates. We weren't exactly in the same friends circles, but enough common friends for to be all right. And Iron Maiden were playing in Birmingham, NEC. I think it was Christmas after we'd left school. So it's actually more like college, really. But 2 16-year-olds going to go see Iron Maiden at the NEC in Birmingham. And Anthrax, the support act, and Oliver's big into Anthrax. So we get around into the front, naturally, and then fills up behind us, and then it's the most frightening experience of my life. The guys walk on the stage, and me and Oliver said, we stay next to each other. 3 notes in, and the mosh pit had started, and we were just flung. I don't think I saw Oliver for an hour after that.
The first gig I went to was nothing like Iron Maiden, it was the Wonder Stuff.
All right, okay. Big student type thing.
Good band. And Vic Reeves came on singing Dizzy as well.
Oh, of course, so that'd be 1990,
91-ish. 91, really. Yeah. So I didn't get to see any live bands when I was in the 80s, which is a shame.
And in fact, if I'm honest, I think when I did the sums again, I think the Alarm was like January 1990 or something. So strictly speaking, never saw any live bands in the 80s.
We've missed out on some.
I know.
So talk me through what you do now, music-wise.
Okay, so... So about 2 years ago, I set up myself as an independent promoter. 3 years ago, I didn't know what that meant. But a promoter, I learned, is basically somebody who puts the gig on, books the venue, books the artist, and sells the tickets. I've always been, I guess, a natural salesman type. I can sell, and I can put a deal together. So that's what I do now. So I set up Midweek Music Club, named because after I'd split with my ex-wife, see the kids at the weekend, and I need something to do during the midweek. And because I knew I didn't know very much about it, my intention was to become a serious promoter in Manchester. That's what I wanted to be. And I knew that if I did it badly to start with, I could risk screwing up any future chance of it being proper. So the Midweek Music Club was designed as a throwaway thing that I could practice and learn relatively anonymously, make all the mistakes I was going to make, and then ditch that, and then set up Paul Bent Promotions and start properly. But I've been dead lucky, and Midweek Music Club has worked.
You contact bands.
Thankfully, they contact me. Bands want to play, venues want promoters to put bands on. It never occurred to me just how influential the promoter ends up being. And so it's for other people to say, but I think we've built up a reasonable reputation within 2 or 3 venues in Manchester, because we do apply a proper sort of business type model to it. We do our numbers properly, and we do sell properly. So we're seen as, I think, as a relatively safe pair of hands for most of the venues in Manchester. So they will give us dates, no problem. So we get typically 2 or 3 dates a month from our particular venues, and it's my job to say, right, okay, so I've got this date. In fact, take tomorrow. So we've got a date at 81 Renshaw, which is a really nice new venue in Liverpool. So I'm the promoter. I decide which bands are going to play, I decide how much we're going to sell tickets for, and we do it. We try and sell tickets, and then tomorrow night, I still love that I get to be involved in the setting up the sound checks and the loading them and setting it all up and designing the posters. And
so you are directly responsible for setting everything
up. I am, yeah, absolutely. I mean, sorry, I'm concerned a bit like full of myself, but yeah. And equally, when nobody turns up, it's on me. But I love it. It's the closest I can get to being involved in live music without having any musical talent.
Has there been anyone that you've been really proud to have gone?
Well, two spring to mind. So there's Dave Sharp, who we haven't put on yet, but we've agreed terms with, and we're going to. And on the 14th of March, I get to put on the guitarist, who was the guitarist at that first gig that I went to see at the Apollo, which it's a special moment for me, that. But equally, two Christmases ago, I got a call from a guy who said, "Hi, I'm Dunstan Bruce. I'm looking to put on a gig midweek in Manchester. I hear you specialise in Manchester midweek." And I don't think he knew at that stage just how novice I was.
Right.
I later known that a friend of a friend of a friend has said, "Oh, I've heard of, there's a Manchester midweek promoter. Yeah. Get in touch with him." And I'd just come back home from a gig that hadn't gone very well. So we'd lost a ton of money. I'd paid the artist far too much. We hadn't sold enough tickets. I was feeling very grumpy about the whole thing. And it's about 11 o'clock at night. The phone rings. "Hello. How you doing? All the intros. Dunstan Bruce here." Now, there's a tiny little noise in my head going, Dunstan Bruce.
You know that name from somewhere.
Exactly. It's too showbiz a name, yeah. Right? That's too cool a name. But of course, I'm not in the mood. And I'm just, "Yeah, mate. What fee are you looking for?" He went, "Well, normally like £100. And I gave him short shrift. I said, "Mate, look, I'm telling you now, you ain't selling enough tickets to make that pay midweek in Manchester without a following." I said, "I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll do £100. All right, and if we sell more than 80 tickets, we'll split the difference. Are you up for that?" He went, "Yeah, sounds good to me, mate."
It's just saying.
Yeah.
Straight.
Right, so finally, I've got one over on the artist. They'll just look up who Dunstan Bruce was. And of course, Dunstan Bruce was the lead singer of Chumbawamba.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I was shocked. I've just been rude to them. And he turned out to be one of the most charming, wonderful men I've ever met. Eventually, we talked. And I couldn't carry on the illusion that I was more expert than I was. And I said, "Look, Dunstan, I just want to be crystal clear. You'll be about our eighth gig." "Okay, that's fine. You know, I said, and there will be a bit where I have to get the fanboy stuff out of the way. I was a massive fan. And then we get into the, oh, you're good." And that was fine. I went, so I met him. We've kept in touch since. I could phone him up now and see if he wanted to put on a gig. Absolute gentleman. Loved working with him. And at that time, it was our best commercial gig. So it was the first time we'd sold tickets other than the ones that I'd sold. It was so nice just being able to put in Interrobang, that was about his name, and they had enough fans that would just buy tickets.
It's mental, isn't it, that you can just get a phone call from a famous person.
Yeah.
And to them, they're just not famous. They're just a human that want to put a gig
This is the beautiful thing, right? I don't know what I'll be like with Dave Sharp when I meet him, but I think these guys are all right with, "I was a big fan, mate, and I still am. But let's be professional now, so..." And I know what I'm talking about. It's like, "So, you're on at this time, this is your set list, you need to be loaded in here, come and meet Pete, Pete's your engineer, if you can get your sound check done in the next 40 minutes, you've got some food in the dressing room, what do you need from me, do you want a drink, do you want water, what's your policy on selfies with fans, do you want to meet and greet afterwards?" Because the stardust thing has gone. It is just a job now. Mm-hmm. But there are moments where I get to sit and go, "I made that happen." Because you must be the same. You've got as many eight famous guys from when we grew up. You've probably been through that loop far more times than I have. There's been one occasion when I've had too much to drink and shown off about a mate to Dunstan Bruce. It was at a friend's son's wedding. I had too much to drink, and I wanted to play tub thumping because it's a great good song. And I wrote a message. I can't remember. I'd done the awful joke. And I'd said, "If I can get Dunstan Bruce on the phone, will you play it?" Junker, really. So he did, and he did. But then I spoiled it all by doing the, "Thanks very much, Dunstan. Would you like a drink?" "Not a whiskey drink. Not a lager drink. Just a cider drink." And of course, my whole world collapsed. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.